Iraq. I also, through sheer serendipity, happened to be the epigrapher on Dr. Moon and that project. So I'm speaking with two hats on here. Before I move on to welcome Dr. Moon and introduce the lecture, I have had a couple of bits of Institute housekeeping. First of all, to welcome both members and non-members. I hope that the number of non-members in the building will have diminished significantly by the end of the evening. There are membership leaflets downstairs. They are very affordable and very good value to join, and I would urge you to do so. Secondly, I have a delightful piece of news to share with you. A long-standing, very eminent member of the Institute, Professor Joan Oates, has just this week been awarded the British Academy's Graham Clark Medal for Prehistoric Archaeology. So. Sadly, Joan can't be with us tonight, but I will be writing to her on behalf of the Institute to give her our warmest congratulations. Joan has been involved in the archaeology of northern Iraq since the 1950s and has transformed our understanding of millennia of Iraqi history and prehistory. It is a highly deserved prize. And Augusta McMahon also pointed out today that she is the first woman to receive this medal too, and I think that's an outstanding achievement. Talking of outstanding female archaeologists, here's one I prepared earlier. Dr. Jane Moon, who will be giving us the lecture this evening, is co-director of the excavations, the Ur Regional Archaeology Project, along with Professor Stuart Campbell, University of Manchester, and Dr. Robert Killick, who's also here this evening. So, Jane and Robert and Stuart, too, are long-standing members and friends of the Institute and the school before. Not quite, I should add, as long as though, but certainly a very happy and productive relationship that has gone back many decades. And the Institute is very proud to have been one of the founder sponsors of this project. We contribute now as just a small proportion of the very of the cost of the project, which is funded by a variety of sources. So all of those in the viewing room who do contribute financially to the project, a big, big thank you. So without further ado then, I shall hand over to Jane to tell you about recent archaeological work in some. Excellency, friends and colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, this is a day I never thought would come. When I first came to one of the ISSI November gatherings, I think at the instigation of Joan Oates, it was almost 40 years ago to the day, and I never thought the day would come and I would actually be the one to stand at the front of the room and tell an assembled audience about the wonderful archaeology in southern Iraq. So thank you for coming today to be part of what is actually a very special celebration for me. There is another reason, of course, that I never thought this day would happen. I don't need to remind anybody here what terrible times there have been in Iraq recently, still going on. And it seemed for a long time that it wouldn't actually be possible to do any work in southern Iraq. Happily, that is not the case. And without further ado, I would like first of all to explain to you why I think it's important to excavate in southern Iraq. It may be very obvious to some members of the audience. I will explain how we've done that, how we're going about it. Of course, I will tell you what we found there, because that's what you've come to hear. And then I'm going to tell you where you come in, because everybody comes in somewhere. We are digging in ancient Babylonia, which is, of course, the area effectively between the heartland of would say is between Baghdad and Nasiriyah. Basra, of course, wasn't there. The head of the Gulf was further north. And Babylonian heartland was in that part between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Also goes up the Euphrates because of the great trading connections that were necessary to maintain this amazing culture. I'm going to be talking about the Old Babylonian period. That's very roughly 2000 to 1500 BC, very roughly, round numbers. I'm telling you that because I have sat through lectures in this hall where I've been kept in suspense to the very last moment as to what the date was of the things I've been shown. So I'm telling you that now. If you don't like Old Babylonian, now is the moment to leave. Door's still open. Why would one want to excavate in southern Iraq? Of course, because it is the cradle of civilization and the best place in the world to excavate. After I'd been to my talk here 40 years ago, I did head off to Iraq on a three-month grant, and I ended up staying the best part of 10 years. In that time, I excavated in many parts of the country, though never in Kurdistan, because that was the area it was difficult of access, difficult to get permission, very hard to do anything in. And it's wonderful that today these neglected provinces are being given the attention they deserve. However, there are, I think, more than 30 field projects going on in KRG, and to my certain knowledge, I'm a bit more certain about this number, there are two in the whole of the rest of Iraq. And while one doesn't want to take anything away from what's happening in Kurdistan, of course not, I do feel that the balance needs to be redressed just a little bit. Now, I know what you're all thinking. You're all thinking nobody in their right mind would want to excavate in Anbar or Nineveh or Sabah al-Din. No, of course they wouldn't. These places, tragically, are quite beyond the pale. However, that does leave us quite a lot of other provinces which are relatively settled and perfectly good for doing archaeological work in, very neglected. So if we just needed one good reason, that would be it, I think. I'm going to be talking about the Dhiqar province, of which the capital is Nasiriyah. That's that one there. We'll just go back about 4,000 years or so and have a look at it in the Old Babylonian period. Have a look at Iraq in the Old Babylonian period. You will notice that most of the cities do happen to be in the south. Those of you who are linguists will be able to pop the bits that are missing off the towns onto the end there. You see the trading cities, the other great old Babylonian cities going up into Syria, unfortunately also out of bounds at the moment. But I want to talk about an area that's been neglected recently, and particularly about this area here, which has perhaps in some ways been the most neglected. Or, of course, the great city of Ur, possibly doing the same job back then as Basra does today. It being the place where you have access to the part of the world, to the south and the east, and all that way. Ur needs a little introduction to this audience. Traditional biblical home of Abraham, of course. Excavated by Leonard Woolley in the 20s and 30s. Still a very popular place with visitors. I tweet from time to time. My Twitter name is Aya Nasser because I have a particular soft spot for the merchant Aya Nasser who lived at Ur and who cheated all his customers. We try not to do that. But there was an irritating tweet the other day saying, why should Iraq, of all places, need a tourism minister? Well, I tweeted back in no uncertain terms. Ur is very popular with tourists, local tourists of every kind. Our house is just near there when we're excavating. And people come past all the time. They watch us playing cricket in the garden and stop and ask to have their photographs taken with us. And it's all very congenial. This is, of course, the wonderful reconstruction of the ziggurat done by Taha Bakr in the 1950s. The other well-known excavation from this area is that at Ur Eridu, done by the wonderful Seton Lloyd and Fuad Zafar. I've got a picture of Seton Lloyd. If anyone's got one, I'd like one. But that's Professor Fuad. Two of my personal archaeological heroes who discovered this wonderful sequence of temples at Eridu. And that was in the 1940s. Since then, there has been almost no major work in this area of southern Iraq. For that reason, and for one of
two others. In 2012, Robert Killick and I headed back to Iraq. For the first time, I think, in 25 years. Aided by Bissy and one or two other people who helped out, to see if we could find a place to start some new excavation work. There are many types of archaeology, and for Iraq in recent years, the types that do not involve excavation have been perhaps the most popular. Landscape archaeology, survey perhaps, looking at satellites and so on. But I feel very strongly that excavation is important for many, many reasons. Somewhere in the popular articles that got written about us, it's sometimes said we were the first international expedition to return. That's not actually so. It was the Stony Brook expedition, who were in residence at Bor at the time, with Abdulmir Hamdani, pictured here, being my interpreter, who is head of antiquities in Dikar. I owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude for helping us to look for sites, for putting us up, for helping us. The character on the left, also very important, he's the sheikh of a local branch of the Al-Ghizi tribe, and we are effectively under his protection. He finds us guards and workmen and so on, and he's as vital to our safety there as the rather tough-looking Kurds in the background, though they're pretty good too. There's a rather shy Slim Khalaf peeping out from behind Abdulmir there. All very important. The other expedition there, by the way, is not Stony Brook. It's Roma La Sapienza, who are very good friends and colleagues to whom I also owe a great deal for the cooperation we've had with them. So here we are back in Iraq after 25 years. A lot of things had changed. One or two things happened. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't even know whether we'd be welcome or not. Well, I was soon put right on that score. We couldn't have been made more welcome. In fact, it was rather humbling how pathetically pleased people were to see us. Another thing that had changed was the media attention. Siyaha, politics. Politics. You see, I've forgotten it already. It's a word I didn't know. I never learned when I was young. We never talked about it. Journalist? Sahafi? Yes, that's another word I didn't really know. We kept well away from journalists. We didn't like to tangle with the media at all. We were afraid for everybody's sake back in those dark days of the 70s and 80s. Now everybody wants to take our photograph. Everybody wants to interview us. Everybody wants to film us. And though it takes some getting used to, it's wonderful. It's really flattering. It's so nice that there is so much communication. Every Iraqi I know, even the pop boys, have a mobile phone. They all want to be my friend on Facebook. And I think this is, you know, this will probably do more to spread. Even the guards want to be my friend on Facebook. Why not? This will do more to spread the word about Iraq's fantastic heritage possibly than anything else. So we looked for a site. I said no major excavation had been done in the area since earlier, way back in the 30s and 40s. In the 1960s, Henry Wright did a survey of this area. Between Orr and Larsa is up here somewhere. Between Orr and Larsa and all around here. I'm sorry about the names. I don't know why they've done that. Please improvise and see if you can work them out. He mapped all the sites in this area, and we were particularly interested in one pair of tells called Tel Khayba here. The naming is complicated. I'm just calling them Khayba 1 and Khayba 2 because I think that's simple. These are the two we had a look at. They're about 40 kilometres northwest of Ur and about halfway to Larsa, effectively. Another thing that's changed in 25 years, of course, we can now look at satellite images and aerial images, which was always forbidden us before. And this has made a huge, huge difference. I love showing this because I can see all the archaeologists in the audience, they all lean forward. And everybody else is looking slightly bemused. It's a satellite image. What do you see? That's the Modern Canal, obviously. Ignore all these tire tracks, such as coalition Humvees making a nuisance of themselves. Never drive over a tell. Your tire marks will be there for archaeologists to find. No, what we're looking at is this. Here you can see a very large building. There's another part to it, or possibly another building, we weren't sure here. This tell, this is Khayba meters in extent and the building is about 80 meters long. So it completely dominates it. We weren't looking for a big city to dig. They are practically impossible to dig. We weren't looking for a small village like Zacharyzorya. I forgot to mention that when I said no significant archaeology. Henry Wright did excavate a small third millennium village, which was a great sort of beacon of good practice in looking at environmental material and so on. So we wanted a medium-sized place, one we could tackle and make an impact on, but one with some significance. And that building, I think, is pretty significant. I'll show you some better photos of it later. We wondered what it was, of course. That's the Ouathri Temple at Umma. Unfortunately, another sign of the times, very visible there, lots of looting, lots of robber holes. Nawala Mutawali of the University of Baghdad rescued what she could, excavated this. And I think you'll see the similarity. Small part, larger part, little rooms around the edge. We wondered if perhaps we had an Ouathri temple like that. Personally, I was rather hoping for something early third millennium, because I kind of feel at home in the third millennium. And Henry Wright had picked up a lot of ED1 Gender NASA early third millennium pottery from the time when the time of state formation. It's a very interesting period and not well known, but it was not to be. Now, we'll go back to Khaybar in just a minute. When I said I spent 10 years in Iraq, I did learn quite a lot about excavation techniques and quite a lot of other things there. Still plenty more to learn. In the gap after that, I did some work in Bahrain along with Robert Killick and Harriet Crawford from UCL. This was on a site called Saar, which is in Bahrain in ancient times was called Dilmun. This is roughly Old Babylonian too. This is early Old Babylonian. This was a 10-year project in which we tried to apply the things we'd learnt in Iraq, but to build on them as well. We tried to move things along a bit. One of the ways we moved things along a bit was in looking at how you resource excavation work. And we were lucky to be able to find corporate funding, which meant, shall I be blunt, that we could do the job properly. We also took a new look at staffing. It's very tempting to go into the field with a couple of graduate students because they're cheap and they'll do what you say, you hope. Or possibly a couple of colleagues who you hope are scared of you as well, but have to spend the rest of the year doing lectures and so on. These people are, of course, very important. You do need specialists. But it's also, I think, a huge omission to not take professional archaeologists who, after all, really know what they're doing. British professional archaeologists are some of the best in the world. Why not use them? There's also a very particular place for volunteers. We built a big volunteer program at Saar, so successful that some of the volunteers are still here tonight, which is just wonderful, which enabled us to do things, to be serious again, enabled us to do things we wouldn't have been able to do without their willing manpower. We also took a new look at how you disseminate and publish your information. If you're not going to publish it, you shouldn't touch it. And if you don't know how you're going to publish it, I'm not sure that good intentions are quite good enough. A promised note to self to spend the rest of my spare time for the rest of my life doing the publication. No, that's not good enough either. And the traditional way of publishing, a series of monographs, usually financed by a grant given to a publisher, we didn't find satisfactory. We did this with our first volume, The Dilmun Temple, published in 1995 while the excavations were still happening. After that, we set up our own publishing company, which we found we got on with much better. And we were able to disseminate the volumes quite widely and quite cheaply by asking our sponsors to pre-buy large numbers, which they liked for Eid presents and Christmas presents, and everybody was happy. And it also enabled us to do things in colour, to make things more accessible, and so on. Nowadays, we would move on again. A prime way of disseminating is, of course, on the internet, and I think there's also a big place for print on demand. So, armed with some of the things we had learned and hoping to build on them again, we headed back. The most important thing, of course, are the resources. forces. We couldn't move a muscle without all these wonderful supporters. And I'd like to say thank you to each and every one of them here and those who haven't made it tonight, because they actually make it possible. So their generosity, particularly to Baptism. So there we are. We've got our budget, we hope. We've got our permit. We've got our site. It's definitely time to head back to Babylonia. And before I'd like you to come with me, we'll be going in just a moment. I'd just like to pause one more second to say thank you for the amazing team that I took with me. They're not running away. I know it looks like it here, though they probably felt like it. For their patience, their hard work, their professionalism, and actually their sheer nerve in coming with us to a place that they had no reason to believe was at all safe. Okay, some archaeology. I said that Henry Wright of the University of Michigan, who I finally caught up with 2 weeks ago in Michigan, this is a wonderful moment, had already looked at the site, and I wrote to him when we wanted to excavate it, and he sent me his notes from 1966. I know nobody but Henry Wright who would know where his notes from 1966 were. I certainly don't know where any of mine are, but Henry had them, and he sent them. And what he had done was he picked up the surface pottery, of course, and had a good look and made a map. There was a lot of early Third Millennium pottery, which tempted me. I started looking at that satellite image again and trying to see the big gem that NASA building in it. I tried. But Henry did warn us that the area around where the big building was later. He had it down as early Third Millennium, possibly a little later. It's one thing seeing a building on a satellite image. It's another finding it on the ground when you get there. The first thing we did was to repeat the surface survey to see if we could improve on Henry's results. And also, if you're going to pick up surface shows, you need to do it, especially on a smallish site, before they start getting kicked around by all the workmen, which inevitably happens. It's also an exercise because you can involve people of perhaps not much experience or ability, and everybody can get involved. And that is part of why we're there. We're not just there to do an international expedition, bring the results home, publish them in academic journals. This is all about engaging the local practitioners as well. This was an easy way of doing it. Results? No, we didn't improve on what Henry had found at all. In fact, it just confirmed it. But it was worth a try. At this point, I will introduce you to Stuart, for anyone who doesn't know him. The University of Manchester, we approached them to get involved in the project. We'd approached a couple of others whose responses could possibly be summed up as, no, thank you. And Stuart just said, how soon do you think we could start? So I knew the University of Manchester was definitely a very good choice. But Stuart's head of archaeology at Manchester. He's also a prehistorian, which is good. This is excellent because it means we can use the techniques of prehistory to look at a historical site, and therefore we can get it from both sides, if you see what I mean. He also comes with all the latest techniques. This is a gradiometer. I've never had much luck with ground-penetrating instruments in Iraq and in a mud brick environment where your walls are built of living mud brick. They fall down, and so you've got a lot more mud brick. And none of these instruments, in my experience, have been particularly good at picking up walls. But things improve all the time, and we thought we'd give it a go. And also, again, it keeps the locals involved. It kept the security detail out of mischief for a few days, because bless them, they get very bored. And it looked a bit like this. You can probably just see a wall cornering here, sort of there-ish. Yes, it sort of worked, but I'm not sure we were any wiser than when we started. So, while we firmly believe we did not go back to Iraq after 25 years to take only the techniques of 25 years ago, sometimes there is a case for doing something you just know is going to work, which is getting a row of strong young men with hoes and asking them to scrape about that much off the surface. This was just before the Iraq-Iran war. I often wonder what happened to these lads. I know what happened to that one because that's Robert. But the rest, I wish I knew more about. Once you do that, if you're in the right conditions, it has to be a little bit wet. It's good if it's winter. You can see wall lines very clearly, the tops of the walls coming up here. At which point you ram red flags in there as fast as you possibly can, because the minute it dries out, you will see nothing. You therefore have to plan very carefully, of course. And in the case of the planning, we do not revert to the techniques of 25 years ago or beyond. We like to be as cutting edge as we can, because the other practitioners in the room will know that when you've finished and you come home, you do not want a mess, a stack of bits of paper which you've got to find room in somebody's office. You need something much more user-friendly. So we plan straight into, we use a Panasonic Tough Pad and a program called PenMap, which you can draw freehand onto, all of which can go into a GIS. It's immediately geo-referenced, is the point. And you can use this not only for the big level planning, but also, as seen here, for finer detail, such as this grave, which Mary Shepherdson's planning here. You throw your traditional planning grid down at your feet over the skeleton, and you get a virtual planning grid on your pad, and off you go. You can draw straight onto it, and all that ties up with everything else once it's connected, all up in the evening. Of course, new techniques take some getting used to. When you've learned to do something well, it's hard to part from it. And sometimes the people working with us complained that pen and paper would be so much easier, and they would just felt like kicking the tough pad or throwing it on the ground and jumping on it. To which I could only respond that they're welcome to, because the tough pad doesn't mind the rain or the dust or the wet or being stamped on or kicked, and it certainly doesn't mind being sworn at. And they are absolutely wonderful. So, in, I think we did 4 weeks of excavation in 2013, and I think it was 9 earlier this year. I did kind of lose count. A little bit of scraping and a little bit of excavation, and what have we got? We've got an entire vast building. It really is there. There it is. I think that's a fantastic achievement for that amount of time and resource. We've got a 3-metre thick wall. We've got the building, this part of the building going round like this. Another part has been built on. This is built up against this. Goes round like that and joins up. There's a row of storerooms here. There's another, going to be another row there when we get a chance to look at them. And those little rooms around the edge weren't around the edge at all. Well, they were around the edge, but they were stuck on the outside of the edge, like this. We can take another view of it. Once we add in the information from the satellite and a bit of common sense, it reconstructs like this. Not sure that those are there on the north side, but they probably are. But everything else there's evidence for. What on earth is it? Well, these aren't buttresses. Our rooms. We've only got evidence, possible evidence for one doorway, but I think they're going to turn into rooms. The ones we've looked at have brick floors, so I don't think they're buttresses. And I don't think they're defensive towers either. At least, I hope I'm never in a building needing to be defended with those kinds of towers, because it doesn't really work, does it? Your attackers would get in here, and the people in the towers here would not be able to shoot along the line. They'd be shooting people tower opposite. So a lot of people try to tell me it's defensive, and I'm not really buying it at the moment, but you know, we're open to suggestions. The open bits are not open space. These are just the bits we haven't got to yet. So it's certainly not looking much like an Ola III temple, or indeed anything else of that ilk. So far we have looked at this room here, we've had a little look at this room, we've started looking at a couple of these magazines here, and we've had a look at a couple of the outer rooms. We haven't really got to original floor level in any comprehensive way, so the parts we have excavated are of reuse or abandonment. So please bear that in mind when we talk about the dates and that sort of thing. Here's a better look at it. Looking down from the north corner gives you a better idea of what it might have been like. I think monstrously impressive. Shall we have a look inside, see what we found inside it? Let's start with this room here. Here's what we found in that room there. Oh, I like that noise. Yes, we thought so too. Cuneiform tablets. course, they are cuneiform, they are in Akkadian, they are in the Old Babylonian dialect of Akkadian. And you don't need to know cuneiform to know that that's a list, to know that these are lists. They are administrative documents. Our epigraphist is working very hard on them. I'm sure if you've got any detailed questions about these, Eleanor will answer them. But there they are. 19 we've found so far, and there are still more in situ waiting to be found. They tell us, I think, that there was some administrative function, some major administrative function going on in this large building dominating this relatively small site. Many of them relate to quantities of barley. As most of you will know, the old Babylonian period and many other periods of Mesopotamian history have barley as the oil that runs the wheels. Barley, grain, was almost like currency. It was the most important resource. Southern Iraq doesn't have many resources, apart from human ingenuity, which it has in spades. But otherwise, natural resources, mud, dates, reeds, that's about it. And dealing with the agricultural surplus was actually what made the empire happen. So that's what we have for the moment. They don't, unfortunately, come up looking like this. They come up looking like this, which is what slowed us up earlier this year and why we didn't actually get as much exposure of original floor levels as we would have liked, but inshallah, there's always 2015 and beyond. The salination, the salt in southern Iraq, if you've dug there, I don't need to even remind you about it, you'll know what I mean. It's absolutely horrific. And that was one of our big fears going back, that the salination would be such that the bone material and so on, the seed material, would be worthless. More of that in a moment. The fact that the tablets come up like this means that you do not leave home without a professional conservator. This is something Nicholas Postgate drummed into me at Abu Salabi, and we never go into the field without one. This one we share with the Italians, Giulio Barella, who also took some of the nicer photographs a bit further along. Do we have a date? Well, people who write lists often write the date and the address in the top left-hand corner or thereabouts, and we were hoping for a date. Actually, there weren't any dates so far on the administrative tablets, though I'm sure some of them will have, and it wasn't one of those nice, smart, multi-tabular ones. It was this miserable little specimen here that actually yielded the date. This little tablet, it's about that big, was in the bottom of a pot in the tablet room, probably waiting to be melted down and reused. But that has the ghost of a date there. I'll leave that to the cuneiform specialists to explain in detail. But essentially, the date is the 38th year of Hammurabi, the year he destroyed Eshnunna by flooding the walls. Hammurabi, I'm sure you know, Hammurabi, the lawgiver, possibly the greatest of the old Babylonian kings, not the first by a long way, but the one who briefly united all the cities of Babylon under Babylon. And it's his fault that the history of that part of Mesopotamia for the next many hundreds of years was the history, effectively, of Babylon. All went slightly wrong in the reign of his successor, Samsu-iluna, who faced a lot of rebellion, particularly in the south where we're working. In fact, many scholars believe that the south was, if not depopulated, certainly de-urbanized during his reign. But that's the date we're looking at. We are somewhere in there. We have the 38th year of Hammurabi. So that was a real eureka moment. We have another date. We have three fragments of stamped brick of the reign of Amar-Sin of the 3rd dynasty of Ur, so much earlier. These were found not by the professional conservator, but by the sharp-eyed Nasrallah Mohsen, who was washing the pottery, found those among them and recognized them. Nasrallah and his brothers live at Ur. They're the grandsons of workmen who actually worked for Leonard Woolley, all of them passionate about archaeology and a wonderful asset. I don't expect to find 3rd dynasty of Ur remains on the site. Maybe. But little bits of stamp brick have a way of wandering, and I'm not expecting a 3rd dynasty building underneath. And I'm certainly not expecting an early 3rd millennium occupation that we can look at. We do find Chandan Nasa ED1 pottery and clay cones, but they're all finely minced up in the old Babylonian material. What else did we do inside the building? Well, with our prehistorian advising us here, we have a very careful sampling strategy. This is two of the magazine rooms up here. We divide spaces like this up into discrete sample areas and treat each one separately, hoping eventually to be able to know exactly what came out of any particular part of a room, how the room was used, in other words. We take micromorphological samples. At the moment, we're using this very sophisticated micromorphology box, which is actually the back of a light switch available in Redhair in the souk, but we will be getting the proper boxes in due course. These are undergoing preliminary analysis by Lisa Marie Shito at the University of Edinburgh. Very preliminary, but you can see there are phytoliths in it, plant remains. That's a row of reeds all placed there in a line. I don't know what was stored in these magazines originally, but in these higher levels, they were certainly being used for something quite dirty. There's a lot of straw lying about. There are even temporary ovens people have cooked in them. So you start to think about Samsu Iluna and the mess he made of southern Iraq. And you wonder if perhaps this building wasn't reused as something not at all administrative, people perhaps taking shelter. But I'm letting my imagination go ahead. We also, of course, do very careful sieving to recover smaller pieces, water sieving, flotation. Having adapted the Americans' flotation machine, I don't think they'll ever forgive us if they get that, but it does work better now. There's quite a few scholars at the moment are suggesting that our view of the old Babylonia and at other periods, our view of the economy of the historic parts of Mesopotamia is perhaps biased because we're reading from tablets a lot. And tablets mention large quantities of grain. Tablets mention flocks of sheep that belong to temples and so on. Tablets do not mention people going wild fowling or fishing. And perhaps we are not getting the right picture. So that's another reason we're doing all this careful environmental work. You can see that you wouldn't demand a receipt from these ladies for anything you bought. It wouldn't be a written transaction. So far, however, that is not what we're finding. Again, this is very preliminary. These are preliminary identifications made by Nick Overton, who you saw for his sins operating the flotation machine. That's not a lot of fish. We're talking about 14,000 specimens here. That's not a lot, I don't think. However, time will tell. We do know that the pig is all domestic. It's not wild boar, but an interesting thing. We've got 60% identification, which is really, really encouraging in a saline environment to have that level that can be identified straight away. The bones are also being looked at by Terry O'Connor in York, who's also given us some preliminary indications, and we'll take this further in due course. Certainly fishing was going on. In this other room in the southern part of the building here, we find a discarded fishing net. Of course, it's long since disappeared, but it's represented by its little weights, all made out of pock shirts with a hole gone through. I think if we find a single further pock shirt with a hole in, our cataloguer would probably jump off the ziggurat or go home and cry. They all have to be catalogued, of course, same as everything else, and photographed on both sides. Again, I think this is probably reuse of the area. I can't imagine you would sling a fishing net into what was probably an office. And there were certainly boats around, so rather miserable little boat models, about this big, found in one of those strange little outer rooms, along with other strange clay things, clay models of animals, that sort of thing. We found evidence of plenty of other activities, plenty of just normal everyday tools, these needles, they're about so long. And I love the way they're worn shiny with use. They've obviously been used a great deal, this little pointer, maybe to drill holes in leather. It's nice to get close to people when you find things like this. Plenty of evidence for grain production. These are, of course, the infamous notched stone sickles which turn up everywhere, and are also the despair of the poor photographer. There are far too many of them. They were used by being stuck in a row, for those of you who don't know, into wooden handles to minjar, is that the word? And sickle, minjar, not minjar, is it? So. And minjar, thank you. pottery, no shortage of pottery. Never is on a Babylonian site. We had 60,000 fragments of pottery, well, pieces, some of them fragments, just this year alone. We are very, very pleased to have our first fully funded PhD. Daniel Calderbank at Manchester will be studying this pottery as part of his thesis. And it's early days, he's only just started, but already I think all Babylonian pottery people in the audience, these are a bit late, aren't they? They're not really Hammurabi, I don't think. They're starting to look a bit more middle of the second millennium, which will be okay, because we are still in the upper levels. Also possibly a little later is this little, what's left of a little figurine. He's about so big. It's got an inscription to Gula, the goddess of healing. And this, I think, I've just learned very recently, is Middle Babylonian, possibly. I think so. So again, pushing along to the other. This was found very close to the surface, and the practitioners in the room will spot the recent break, so I mean, try to disguise it. We should have possibly have had the head there. Gula, the Gula symbol was a dog. It may have been a dog figurine. We do not have the head. This is one of the problems we face. The archaeology is right on the surface, and the crust is extremely hard. And particularly working, this came from the 2013, working with inexperienced workmen, it's really, really hard not to break anything. We're trying our best. One or two other oddments. Only one cylinder seal. Disappointing, as we have cylinder seal experts in the room. Only this one, which was made of clay and isn't particularly spectacular, but it is wonderfully old Babylonian. It's a Babylonian presentation scene. Here's the supplicant approaching the seated god. He's sort of making an act of obeisance, but he's rather a stretch. And all these creatures just wandering through the scene. Mother goat, baby goat, just wandering through, a couple of birds on their way through. It could be one of the temporary seals, perhaps, that were used in the old Babylonian period and made of clay. Perhaps it was a practice piece. I think if you were practicing seal cutting, you would practice on clay rather than the more usual precious stone, I would. Found again in one of the little outer rooms there. Can you see this? Can you see this bit? We need the lights down some more. It's okay. Talking about the public building and what we've done with it so far. Obviously, you wouldn't take a balanced view of what's happening on a settlement just by its large public building, even if it's a very large one, even if it does dominate the settlement. We have had time to look very briefly at a row of private houses that are a not great distance from the public building, little row of old Babylonian houses here. They are, like so much, not preserved up to threshold levels, so we don't know how they interconnected. So I guess at the moment, they're perhaps not telling us all we would like, but time may tell. But you'll notice in this one here, there's intramural burial let into the corner of the room. Classic double pot burial. If you don't know these, you have two pots and you stick them together like that. The occupant goes stretched out between the two pots, inside the two pots. Though actually in the case of this one, the occupant was all scrunched up in that one, which seems a little odd. There was nothing at all in this part, and it wasn't robbed. She was a lady of about 30 years old, buried with a single pot. Again, I think, I'm happy to be corrected, but I think looking a little more late old Babylon. precious stones, quite crude, turquoise, agate, lapis. Nice, but very, very worn. She'd obviously worn it for a very long time, bless her. And these two pins, which are pectorals here. And our portable XRF, another new device imported by Stuart, which we're grateful for. We're able to take readings immediately on the elements and things. This is important because this sort of thing is important because we're not going to see these objects again. They are, of course, all turned over to the Iraqi authorities. Minor principle, I'm sure they'd be very happy for us to go to Baghdad and study them. In the current climate, this isn't really very feasible. So we need to get all the information we can before they are turned over. These two pins turned out to contain both copper and silver, which I think is really rather unusual. Also in this area of private houses, there were quite a lot of rich copper finds. These are spearheads and other projectiles, this sort of size, in rather nice condition. Even a copper mirror. It doesn't look like much there, but when Julia had finished with it, it did look quite a lot nicer. And again, you wonder why all this valuable stuff was left there, or why there should be spearheads on the ground. Perhaps times weren't too happy back then either. Or possibly they were just lost or buried. We may find out in time. Now, I talked about the way we do the planning. Equally important is how you record the objects. People probably get tired of hearing me say that digging is the easy bit. It's finding out what you found, turning all that information into actual, into being able to tell you something about the ancient world that's important. And with the objects, it's the same thing. They're all recorded, they're all immediately 3D'd as soon as they're found. Put into the GIS. This example is the tablet room, and I've just shown the tablets. But you can equally well just filter it to show you the contours, the levels, every find less than 2 centimetres long, anything you like. You can then click on any particular one, and there you get all the catalogue information, all the information about the context comes up immediately. If you want to take a closer look, you simply click again, and there's the photograph. And heaven knows it's hard enough trying to make sense of the records you bring home from site without having it all as well arranged as this. It's definitely a way to do it. So there we are. Here's our public building. That, I think, is a crowning achievement so far. So these are early stages. We hope to dig for at least 3 more years if we can. Now, I said I would tell you where you came in. Everybody comes in somewhere. I would really like to hear your ideas about this, because we don't quite know what it is. We think, we're guessing that these rooms, well, not guessing, our best idea is that these rooms were actually the same height as the rest of the wall. When you see a wall that thick, 3 metres thick, immediately think, was there another story? Unfortunately, that's a question we simply can't answer. But it must have been quite tall. I don't think you built a very short wall, 3 metres thick. Particularly, you might. But the way it's joined on here suggests to me that these were the full height. And one begins to wonder if perhaps they weren't a really massive storage facility of some sort. That's just... I have one idea. I'd like to hear yours as well. Here's my idea. I had a look. We decided it wasn't a temple. Yeah, we all agreed. There were 3 temples. Thank you. I was in Chicago the week before last, and I had to argue with a lot of Ouattara temple finders. No Ouattara temple. So I had a look at other secular buildings of the old Babylonian period. Near to us, Larsa, Sukkashi, Palace of Uruk here. Though I fear the German excavators actually made most of that up. But even so, it doesn't look much like that. It doesn't look much like that. And that one's not doing it for me either. I think it's without precedent. I don't know of anything quite like it. So here's my idea, and this comes from just briefly reading around a little bit. Piotr Steinkeller published a study of the names of settlements and the sorts of settlements that there were in the area of Umma. Umma's not particularly close to us, but it's got old Babylonian settlement too. The names of these places were unfortunately not very user-friendly to non-cuneiform people. They're called Guru 7 and Yidub. Never mind that. And these were large, permanent structures that could store huge quantities of grain. You start to wonder about these outside things. If they were tall, would that be a good place to put a large quantity of grain? And then, as Tina Breckvold's study, Tina used to frequent these meetings until she went off to run the Vienna Boys Choir instead. I wish she were here. She wrote her thesis about a group of texts from Larsa in the Yale Old Babylonian collection. Unfortunately, like so very many texts, and this is why Haber and what we're doing, one reason it's so important. The texts she looked at were, of course, acquired in the collection. I won't say looted, that's not fair, because it was a long time ago. But they were acquired, and we don't really know where they came from. What we're finding, we know exactly where they came from. They came from one room, and possibly from around the walls of one room, possibly falling off shelves. Anyway, the tablets that Tina looked at seemed to be about Larsa, which is just up the road after all, Haber's between her and Larsa. And they pertained, again, to large quantities of grain. These were records. Each settlement was obliged to produce a quota of grain, and these records had the quota and the amount actually produced, and then a little bit of arithmetic to show what was still owing for next year. How much it was going to cost to ship it all to Larsa, how many boats were needed, how much you needed to leave behind to buy a new plough oxen the next year or repair the plough, and so on, even how much the boatman needed for beer to drink on the way. And all this was added up, and these were records kept, who had produced what. And I began to wonder if possibly Haber might have been one of these places, somewhere not only tasked with producing a large quantity of grain, but also a big administrative centre controlling it and sorting it all out. Because grain, unlike gold, does decay. It has to be kept carefully. Tina had the names of these settlements. We don't have the name of ours yet. Most of them were, as you would imagine, upstream from Larsa, so you could float the boat downstream with all the grain on it. One was to the southeast in the direction of Laura, therefore Haber. And the poor people there were going to have to get their quota of grain upstream somehow. Much harder work. I'm not suggesting that Haber is sin nor martin. That would be far too neat. But that's just my idea of the sort of place it might be. But as I say, I really would like to hear all your ideas as well. There are some things I think you can only find out by excavation. And excavating is what we need to do here. It's important not just for finding provenance material. It's important not just because it helps move the story on a bit from looting and destruction. Heaven knows we've heard far too much of that. We're actually finding a whole lot more nice things for Iraqi heritage professionals to be proud of. And that is something positive, and it's important. We're not there, obviously, to find objects. We're looking for information, most of which comes from objects. But we're there for some other reasons, too. We're there for these people. Missy, I know, has done amazing amounts of work trying keeping connection with the Iraqi academic community in the years when archaeologists have been isolated from their international counterparts for far too long. And yes, our universities can offer PhD study and so on, and this is wonderful. But there are also people who are not going to be academic specialists. There are professionals, senior ones like Ali Karvin here, head of ULA. He needs support in a different way. He needs to work with people. People at the very beginning of their career, like Akila here, who is not enjoying learning how to draw pottery from Daniel, but he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in the antiquities service too. And again, he needs the sort of support we can only give by actually being there and working at the same time. We need to support people like this. This is Governor Nasri from Nasiriya of Tawrika, risking blessing his very nice suit by getting almost right into the double pot burial. I don't know many people of his stature who would do that, quite honestly. I'd take my hat off to people like that. There are 1,200 known archaeological sites just in Dika, which means there are two or three times more than that, certainly. He wants to put the Nasiriya Museum back together. He wants to promote the heritage of this area. He wants ultimately to use it as an educational resource, as a tourism resource. This is going to happen so much more easily if there's a bit more dialogue between all of us at all levels. We need to be there for people like this, school teachers from Betheh, a little town closest to Khaybar, who want to teach the children about their ancient heritage. The schools have missed out on this. A whole generation is missing out on education of every sort. I have adolescents working for us who can't write their names. This is, you know, something that is going to change, has to change. Excuse me. It's quite emotional when I think about it. I think of the things that aren't as they should be in Iraq. I'm not suggesting we can fix them all, or even many of them. One or two things we can fix or can help to fix. The ancient heritage is seen by everybody as a unifying factor. I'm not just trotting that off my tongue, I'm not saying it glibly. When we go into places like the College of Arts in Nasiriyah, I got dragged in to give a talk about art. I don't know anything about art. It doesn't matter, said my friend. Just say something. You know, they're just so impressed, so nice to have someone from the University of Manchester here. Try and say something. So I tried to say something, and they had written and produced a little play for me. It's a very humbling experience, and by gum, is there some talent there. I didn't understand all of it, but I certainly understood that the theme was Iraqi unity, which they are absolutely passionate about. This is something, you know, that might just help a little bit. As anyone who is over 20, I think most people are over 20, most of you know that in the wake of the first Gulf War, Saddam drained the marshes, he burned the reeds so they could never come back, and he built a great road all the way through to Jubaish as a great symbol of the fact that the marshes were dead. This is Saddam's great road through the marshes. Here it is. What's left of it? We're having a picnic on it, picnic breakfast, which is all it's good for now. And the marshes have come back. And those pictures I showed you earlier of the marshes, they weren't taken in the 70s or the 80s. Those were taken earlier this year. So I'd like to leave you with a thought that, as even the old Babylonians know, things can get better, especially if we help them along to get better. And to do this, we need your support in every possible way. Obviously, the donors have a very specific and very vital bit of support that they give us. But everybody else, just taking an interest, following us on Facebook, Twitter, just spreading the word about what we're doing. It isn't all doom and gloom. Southern Iraq is a wonderful place to work. And what do you see? This is Khaybar 2. It's got an even bigger building on it. So, inshallah, we'll be back in 2015. We'll be taking a little look at this. But we will be doing, I hope, more on the big building, which is telling us so much about Babylonian life and quite a lot about just life in general.